Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. And Nick, we took a week off because there was just too much to digest. Actually, not really. It was more so that everybody watched the semifinals and championship. We didn't really have that much to contribute to the conversation, right?
Yeah, I mean, and the narratives were already so played out. Like, we couldn't even, in our best day, provide insight that wasn't blatantly aware to the public. Maryland's really good. Cornell kind of got a little bit interesting, but at the end of the day, Maryland's good. And that's the thing that we've been saying for like 5 weeks, and the general public doesn't need to hear that Maryland's good still.
So we will quickly recap, and I'll just give a little bit more of like kind of my personal experience on what it was like to go up to Hartford, et cetera. But the majority of this conversation is going to be about essentially giving out superlatives for the 2022 season. You ready?
So ready. This is so great.
All right. Well, yeah, I mean, just because
we've
got a
like,
little...
So I didn't do a good job, like, yeah, classic two guys talking over each other in a podcast, but I have one answer for everything. Like, you sent me the list of superlatives that we're going to go, and I'm like, okay, I'll just get one answer. And I have no backups, but I recently started doing this at restaurants where I know the one thing that I want. And if someone else orders it, then I just panic order. And sometimes it works out great. Sometimes it becomes like a disaster. So I think in the case that if you choose what I wanted, I'm just going to panic. So I'd like to preemptively get ahead of the takes. It's like, oh my God, how could you forget this instance? I've done minimal research and a borderline negligent amount of preparation for this.
So how many times have you ended up with steamed halibut and mashed cauliflower via a panic order?
It's general. I mean, first off, I really appreciate you thinking that I'm healthy enough to panic order like fish and cauliflower. More often than not, it just becomes like banterous with the waiter. I'm like, so he ordered the fried chicken sandwich, which I really wanted. I don't order, like, what would you recommend that's fried chicken sandwich adjacent? And they're like, wow, you are a nightmare. And I really, you better tip well, because this sucks.
You're the reason that I complain to my significant other about this job when I go home.
Yeah, exactly. I recently had a tofu burger, and I was like, oh, just great. And it actually was pretty good. So I played in a men's league game yesterday and just blew out my back because I showed up 1 minute before the game and then shot it as hard as I could, and now I can't move. So I really think I'm going to have to start getting creative about, like, okay, do I really need another cheeseburger driven into my fupa? Or maybe, like, even a tofu burger is a step in the right direction. But I got to be honest, Terry, I'm not keeping up, and the hardware is beginning to fail.
Well, remember when you were doing, like, 200 push-ups and 100 sit-ups a day? How'd that go?
Yeah. So it's good to have, like, oh, a decent chest and, like, you know, my – fat belly is a little bit smaller, but I've just been completely, like, you know, a lacrosse shot that I've taken a million times, is it takes a toll on the body. And to think that I'm just like keeping up with all of the recovery stuff that I did in college and in the pros, when in reality I'm just coming off of aforementioned 5-day bender postseason for the Seals, I think it was just like the perfect balance of I haven't been keeping up with it, I still feel cocky enough, and sit-ups and push-ups are great, but they don't serve the purpose of being dialed in for shooting it 150 miles an hour over the cage.
All right. Well, thank you for Nick's fitness update. I'm looking forward to the next edition in Christmas of 2022 as we prepare for the 2023 college lacrosse season.
Oh, God. All right.
So just quickly in terms of the ultimate weekend of the season. So, of course, Cornell Rutgers kicked things off, and the Big Red stormed out of the gate. It was a question of when the storm hit at halftime of the first game, what was it going to do to the momentum? And despite the fact that Rutgers scored first after the 3.5-hour delay, the Big Red turned it into, I believe, five straight third quarter goals and led at 1.17-7 before Scarlet Knights cut into the final advantage. I believe the final was 17-10. And was really impressed by Ryan Gallagher and Colin Kurst post-game in terms of their composure and how they spoke about their program. Obviously, leading Rutgers to the first Final Four in program history is a momentous accomplishment for the staff and every member of that team, and deserve to be very proud of what they did in the 2022 season. But of course, you know, that was the precursor to Maryland versus Princeton, and it just felt like, I have had the opinion all season long that the only way Maryland was going to lose is if they played poorly. And so the narrative or storyline of the Terps always playing second on Saturday and that usually turning into a bad thing for John Tillman's team was obviously compounded by the fact that the second game was starting about 4 hours after it was originally scheduled to. In addition to which, Cornell was able to take its foot off the gas down the stretch and sub and try to conserve the energy and the body of, you know, a bunch of their contributors because they had built such a big lead. And so even before the Princeton-Maryland game started, it felt like what was normally going to be an advantage for Cornell was actually amplified. And then you saw a Tiger defense that was really, really physical. And then you started to see some injuries rack up to Maryland. You know, first we saw Roman Pugliese's wrist. Then Bubba Fairman looked a little bit gimpy. And then a big hit to Brett Makar late. So, you know, I felt like this was a game where Maryland defensively just strangled Princeton offensively so substantially that the Tigers were never really going to be able to come back. And there were moments in the second half when they managed to make it close, but it was just, it reminded me, honestly, of Loyola's 2012 defense down the stretch, just from the standpoint of how difficult it was to get a step all over the field, something that I think you're familiar with firsthand from that semifinal game. And the Princeton Dodgers just stopped trying to get to the dirt, and they started throwing up, for lack of a better word, lollipops that Logan McNaney just plucked out of the air and sent the other way. At that end of the field, I thought that Tiger defense played Maryland just about as well as you possibly could, and they deserve a lot of credit, but ultimately I believe the final was 12-5, and the Terps were moving on to Monday, and the question became, what was going to be the availability of these guys? You know, Brett Makar came back into the game. It was unclear exactly what his injury was. Certainly on the backside of the hit from Cathal Roberts, I think most people assumed it was some sort of head injury. It was explained that he got the wind knocked out of him. He also had his calf stretched while he was on the ground. So, you know, lingering questions on Sunday. And then obviously with Pugliese, who didn't return and was pictured on the sideline with his wrist in a cast, the question was, what's his availability going to be? So it turned out that basically everybody played for the Terps. And, you know, we saw early Pugliese's inability to actually put pressure on a dodging midfielder, but it really didn't matter because Maryland's offense was so dialed in. They built a 9-2 lead that then Cornell got their footing and started to chip away, and they managed to get it to 9-6 with about 6.5 minutes left in the fourth quarter. And post-game, and D-Fly and Dixie talked about this on their podcast on Friday, one of the things that was being said about this game was if it were 5 minutes longer, Cornell would have won. And I don't accept that, because from 6:37 to 39 seconds left, Cornell had the ball either five or six times and failed to score. So, you know, they were in a position where, you know, they score to make it 9-7 with 4 minutes to go and then score to make it 9-8 with a minute 40 to go, well, then they're guaranteed to get the ball back regardless of what happens at the faceoff dot. And I think that McNaney especially, but the defensive unit altogether for Maryland deserves a lot of credit for how they basically put the clamps on. You know, they failed to clear three times during that stretch, right? So some of this was self-inflicted. But Bubba Fairman was awesome. He, you know, showcased a tremendous amount of effort, energy, and will down the stretch to the extent that You know, he wasn't even really able to celebrate with his team post-game. And the toughness from guys like Makar, and then the tremendous, you know, continued display from Ajax Zapatello was really, you know, kind of what I'm going to be remember of this game, you know, kind of down into the future, and what I think ultimately determined the outcome. So I know that you were otherwise pulled in multiple directions over the course of championship weekend, but what were your thoughts, impressions, memories of the Terps championship?
Well, you know, I think it just comes down to, you know, both teams executing at a high level, but Maryland just doing it more consistently. Like, I still am blown away. And I think it was most transparent in that comeback when everybody kind of started to get on the edge of their seats. And Cornell, like, oh, man, are they actually going to tie this up? I think that they wouldn't have, and I agree with you that if the game went 5 minutes longer, I would probably argue that Maryland actually, you know, gets their lead a little bit further, if for no other reason than the decision-making from Cornell in those moments, I thought was reflective of the overall game and of the overall season. Like, you know, I think other teams, you know, might not be as talented as Maryland, but it's not Maryland's talent that makes them, you know, potentially one of the best in history. It's their decision making and the consistency of their decision making. We've already gone over how they don't take a good shot, they pass it, and then take a great shot. I thought that was representative of like Cornell's inability to do that in those big time moments when, you know, Maryland was completely gassed and they blew it on, you know, I think they turned it over. My count was 300 times in a row on the on the clears, you know, providing Cornell with consistent opportunities that sometimes they buried, but sometimes they took a shot off of their back foot, lollipop stick side high. And, you know, I think that that's a microcosm of something bigger that Maryland, you know, I was actually surprised. I don't think Maryland played their best game. Of course not. But I was surprised that Maryland kind of stooped to a level below what they had set for themselves this season regarding the decision-making and shot selection. Some of the shots, some of the passes, I was like, huh, I wouldn't have expected that from this team. And they're still up 9-2. And so, you know, there's a special place in my heart for roaring fourth quarter comebacks, you know, late in championship weekend. But unfortunately, Cornell's two stick side high shots at the very end was representative of the difference between Maryland and the rest of the country this year. With that being said, I wouldn't put it past a guy like Buzik to hammer that point home for like the next 5 years. Like, I kind of expect big things from Cornell, which, I mean, yeah, super crazy take there as they almost won the national championship this year. But I really think we're going to start seeing Cornell separate themselves because that is something that Buzik can identify and work on. And I think Corrigan does an incredibly good job of that. So, you know, it's good. Congrats, Maryland. I wouldn't put them all as the top team of all time. I did see this take. I'd like to get your thoughts on it. Like the 1990 Syracuse had to do it from the ground up and Maryland just poached everyone from the portal and the portal being new. I don't agree with it because I'm like, listen, the portal is an even playing field for everybody. It wasn't just Maryland that took advantage of it. You know, stop crying about it. But does that need to be taken into account as we stack them up against the historical teams that didn't have the portal?
Great question.
Or the 25-year-olds playing?
So, no. I mean, first of all, two very separate issues.
Oh, no. Okay, Terry.
It doesn't need to be taken into account because I agree with your point. The portal levels the playing field for everybody by creating transparency around who is interested and available to be, you know, to come to your school, to be recruited. Whereas before the portal, it was only done by word of mouth. So yeah, there's an increased volume of transferring because it's easier to transfer. You don't have to get a release the way that you did in the past. You don't have to have a one-on-one confrontational conversation with your coach in order to get your release. Such that I think a lot of kids in years past probably would have just been quit and stayed. Now they're just going to their compliance officer, putting their name in the portal, and then seeing what type of interest comes in. So to me, transfer portal disproportionately benefits the non-powerhouses that otherwise would have gotten the inbound communication from the club director, the high school coach, whoever serves as the intermediary for the player who's interested in transferring. And now it creates transparency around that. If it has benefited Maryland, Georgetown, or anybody else beyond another program, that's just the free market economy working the way that it's supposed to. Their offer is more appealing. So that's why kids are going there. But it hasn't been equally distributed across the former powerhouses. We're talking about Rutgers making the Final Four on the back of, what, like 12 transfers that contributed? Like, Rutgers has not made a Final Four in a men's sport since 1994. Like, this is not the rich getting richer. This is a program utilizing a tool that, to my point, has leveled the playing field. And not every program is going to utilize the tool the same way, the same that nobody ever utilizes a tool the exact same way. And some people who are quicker to adapt to, you know, the new functionality are going to be the ones that benefit early from it. And, you know, it's just like, think about when brands were early adopters of TikTok. And now they have big influential platforms on TikTok, and they've been able to drive revenue in ways that the powerhouse brands haven't been able to do. It's like a similar type of idea. And so, I mean, what does it mean relative to comparing teams from different eras? I think that the only way to actually judge this is to say, how much more dominant were you than your competition over the course of that season, right? Not like if you put two teams on the field, you know, one from 2022, one from 1990, who would win? Like, that's a nonsensical question that we're never going to know the answer to. But you actually can analyze what was the gap between Maryland and everybody else this year, and how is that equivalent to the gap between Syracuse and everybody else in 1990. In 1990, it was before my time. I don't even think I have a memory from the year 1990. Maybe I do. It certainly wasn't about Division I men's lacrosse. But I found it interesting. I have found it interesting how it's been described as a transition year, and that in 1991, a different team went undefeated. So, you know, I mean, 1989 featured the championship game between Syracuse and Hopkins that's widely referred to as the best game ever played. Hopkins graduated a bunch of their stars. And then you look at the other teams that advanced to the Final Four in 1990, including my alma mater. And, you know, it's just considered not to be as strong of a year, at least for the powerhouses, as 1989 was. And I think that 2022 is going to be considered similarly. And there are a lot of reasons that I anticipate we're going to get into about really good teams that weren't a part of the tournament as part of that conversation. But to me, you know, again, you just look at how Maryland compared to their peers this year, and then you look at how Syracuse compared to their peers in 1990, and that's how you start to have a conversation about the best teams of all time.
Yeah, I completely agree. So it is going to be interesting.
This is boring.
Like,
let's move on.
Yeah, well, final point is, if I'm a head coach, it's got to be a little delicate balance where it's like, yeah, we want the best incoming freshman, but let's, you know, who's going to be the first team to shoot themselves in the foot leaning on the transfer portal and not, you know, actually I need to talk to people before I actually form an opinion, but what I'm going to be talking to them about is, are you not going to take a guy that might be iffy in hopes that the transfer portal provides you something? Like, how do you find that balance? What's the timeline look like entering the transfer portal versus, you know, the recruiting regulations? You know, good questions for a guy smarter than myself, but when that's explained to me, hopefully using crayons, I hope I understand it better.
So I've had two conversations in the last 2 days, both with Division I head coaches of teams ranked between 15 and 30. Please say that again, because I, you know, just qualified my brag to make it even sicker.
Yeah, no, between 15 and 30. Okay, cool. Now that all the girls are listening and excited.
So one said, am I just going to sit in my office all summer and not recruit 24s and just host visits for transfers, kids that are in the portal? And I was like, well, how many guys in there do you think can actually contribute to your program? He's like, I think there are 35 players in the portal right now who would contribute to us. And a lot of them are like D3 All-Americans with 1 year of eligibility left. And, you know, others are underclassmen who think they can make a difference. And then the other conversation that I had was about a particular player who's in the portal. And, you know, one of the things about exactly the point that you just addressed, which is how do you balance specifically culturally, right? And, you know, this is something that we've spoken about on this podcast with respect to Jacksonville. And I know that that was something that John Galloway heard.
Hi, John.
Hi, John. We wish we were watching you play Chrome coming up next against the Archers on ESPN Plus. Right now, the Cannons are up 12-3 on the Water Dogs in the third quarter. This is a
butt-kicking. Hope that there's enough champagne for when the Archers score their first goal of the season. Sorry, I'm totally derailing your train of thought. Anyways, so you were talking about the balance, 35 portal kids contribute.
So the second point was about a guy who, you know, has basically bounced around, right? And, you know, the concern is always that if you're leaving your institution, typically you're doing so for reasons that make your arrival at the next institution, you know, problematic. And this coach was just like, it's worth it for us. Like, you know, obviously you have to have your conversations with the kid and his family in order to understand what the reasons for his departure are. But when we have the opportunity to upgrade athletically or skill-wise to the extent that this player represents, the fact that we're doing it after he has a year or two of college experience under his belt at a level higher than our program makes us more certain than we can or should be about a high school junior or senior in terms of his ability to contribute. Not only that, but also there's no guarantee that, you know, a high school player isn't going to have the same type of problem in terms of, you know, looking around. This is a program that has lost transfers, you know, among starters as well, right? So, you know, I think that that's the approach, is that it's still new. We're still working out the nuances of it. Like everything, it's going to represent upsides and downsides, and you're going to have to evaluate them on an individual basis. There's no one answer that works for every coach or every program or every player. So, you know, unfortunately, I think that you're just going to continue to see a case-by-case situation. And, you know, ultimately, that's a good thing. Because, like, what we're really talking about here is what I just, you know, explained a couple of minutes ago, which is that, like, the functional benefit of the transfer portal is making it easier and more transparent for kids to move. Now, there are people who will say that that's a bad thing because it makes it easier to not be committed. And I'm not going to argue with that. That's a value-based judgment that each individual has to make for themselves. But if you're the NCAA worried about student athlete experience and welfare, realizing that a lot of kids probably are miserable and don't move because of the friction associated with moving, and this reduces that friction, that is ultimately a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. Terry, business idea alert. I'm presenting you for a meager $100,000 investment for a 1% stake in my company, Welcome Sharks. Glassdoor, but for colleges that are only available to student athletes in the transfer portal, where it's an aggregation of honest feedback about the program.
Love it. Could see that perfect feature, right, existing, so you want my on InsideTheCross.com someday. Yes, I will write a check momentarily.
Hell yeah.
All right, Nick, you want to talk about some of the best things that we saw this year?
Yeah, I do.
All right. What was your best moment of the year?
So we're starting off with a real tearjerker, Terry. The best moment of the year, I always think, needs to transcend lacrosse a little bit. Yes, we love the game because it's fun and it's exciting and you can shoot piss missiles up to the top 90 degree and hear it go tink off the cage. You can slide high and late with the crown of your helmet. But at the end of the day, it's the humanity stories that always get me, the sensitive, tough guy. And there was no better humanity story than the Clemson-Indiana game, where Indiana sophomore Harris Jaffe. Sorry, buddy. Indiana defenseman, you know, watches a Clemson player collapse into a seizure, administers life-saving you know, EMT, you know, pretty much just saves his life right there on the field. That story explodes. Clemson, Indiana, apparently they keep in touch every now and again, and I loved it. And to have something like that that transcends the entire sport, credit to that young man. I particularly think there wasn't a close second, unless you kind of blow my mind here. But this for me was the creme de la creme, number one overall pick, easiest answer for any superlative of the year.
100%. Can't disagree. When I was going through some of the stuff that I had either posted, written, or seen posted in preparation for this, the only thing that stood out was there were a couple of things, and they kind of both happened in successive weeks. So when Jacksonville beat Richmond, the video of John Galloway playing Black Betty in the locker room, that was a great moment. Doesn't come close to a player saving somebody else's life on the field, but great moment. And then, you know, similarly tear-jerking is when, you know, a player experiences a personal tragedy and then has a response, right? And so, you know, I thought that the week prior in their win over High Point, the midfielder Jeremy Winston scoring 4 goals with his mom in attendance after his dad had died a couple weeks prior, that was another high-end, top-tier moment of the year. So, you know, it just the Jacksonville Dolphins had a good campaign in terms of high-quality moments.
Yeah, completely agree on that. I honestly don't understand how that happens. Like, I know I'm one of the toughest guys of all time, but like just walking through the idea of losing a parent and then having to go play lacrosse, like I wouldn't do it. Like, I don't know if I could ever do it. So I really like that. You know, that's a great answer. And I'll just double down and say, like, you're a better man than me.
Well said. All right. Not to bring the mood down, but hopefully you have some funny answers here. Worst moment of the year. I'll kick this off.
We'll just swap. So you go first.
All right. So I got 3. I'd be surprised if any of these were yours. So mine was the first moment of the season when, once again, Bellarmine Mercer, not available for WebStream. So Scorebreak picked it up, which was great. Thank you, Scorebreak, for stepping in and filling a void. But the stream broke, like, 5 minutes into the game, and nobody was able to watch. And this was the only game on the last Saturday in January, once again, the first game of the college season, and nobody could watch it, and everybody ripped their hair out. To me, a very funny worst moment of the year. My second worst moment of the year was Cornell's game-winning goal against Syracuse, and the reason it was so tough was because what ended up happening was exactly what we saw the Syracuse coaching staff describe not allowing to happen in the huddle on the ESPN broadcast moments prior. And then for me personally, the worst moment of the year was when I refreshed the Albany Great Danes team page and saw that all of the headshots were updated, and basically none of them were actually as funny as they typically are.
I mean, the end of an era, you know. Come on, Albany, need you to step up and get ridiculous with it all.
What was your worst moment of the year?
Do you want me to go?
Yes.
So it was a, you know, I don't think there's going to be any surprise, but, you know, I'm always battling for the little man. I'm a man of the people. I always have been. I always will be. And the worst thing in society, you know, you see it, is corrupt bureaucrats keeping the little man down in the rat race. Meanwhile, they reap all of the benefits from corrupt backdoor deals. And nothing represents the corrupt bureaucracy more than Notre Dame getting snubbed. Everybody excited for what Notre Dame can do. They're clearly, after beating Duke twice, going to be in the tournament. Who potentially could they play? Well, because of the puppeteers, because of the silent leaders that weren't democratically elected, by the way, Notre Dame gets snubbed. And now we will never know if Maryland is actually a good team at all, because they didn't have to play the best teams in May. And so the asterisk that Donna and her corrupt administration put on Maryland to take that away from Maryland. If I'm Maryland, I'm pissed. I don't want people doubting if we had the best season. But let's not forget the historically oppressed Notre Dame men's lacrosse team continues their fight against the corrupt bureaucracies of the world. That was far and away the worst moment of the year, maybe the worst moment in the history of lacrosse, not to be accused of exaggeration. But I mean, that took the wind out of the sails. And I saw more bitching about the tournament this year than any other year on record. And that was 90% of it. Is this game is a snooze fest. And what a shame that is, because this could have been something special.
It's the perfect segue. Once again, you stole one of my answers, but unfortunately, the moment you just described was my bronze medalist for funniest moment of the year.
Okay, so my funniest moment of the year is, like, I love a good storyline, and there's perhaps no better storyline than some kid who didn't, you know, who played D3 and just has an absolute barrel and goes in and shocks Duke and rubs his tummy after he scores a ridiculous goal. Like, I love Waldbaum. And I was thinking about that, or the people's goalie, as Larkin would say, Brown's goaltender. But, like, to have an unbelievably thick player beat a guy, or beat a program like Duke early in the season and then just rub his tummy like he's Buddha, that will forever be ingrained in my memory. And that kind of clicked where it was like, oh boy, here we go. It is lacrosse season. These kids are, you know, coming head first, you know, north, south into hilarious bits. We got all of the funny stuff taken away from us for COVID. And one of the first funny moments of the year is so all time on a program that actually had a good storyline this year. And the best storyline on one of the best storylines is that you have this fat guy rubbing his tummy. That it doesn't get better than that. It really doesn't. So that to me was the funniest moment of the year, and really kind of opened up the floodgates for the bits.
It's a great call. I wonder if my silver medalist is going to make you reconsider, because you found it so much funnier than I did. And it's incredible. I mean, once again, involving the Jacksonville Dolphins. The full field goalie goal against Air Force, uh-huh. And the commentator's yep. reaction, which was completely deadpan.
Yeah. It was like we watched a golf chip shot. Oh, there's a goalie goal. Yeah, that was good aim. Oh.
My funniest moment of the year was not from Division One, but I feel like it is good enough to adventure beyond the normal borders of this podcast. But the commentary on the Worcester-DePauw men's lacrosse game, I posted a thread about this with some of my favorite.
Oh my God, you're exactly right.
That was my funniest moment of the year. And, you know, I really need to revisit it, because one of the things that could potentially be sitting there is that these girls might have called multiple Worcester home games, and I just only scratched the surface by making it through one of them. But yeah, when Sherry O'Terry gets on the mic, that's the funniest moment of the year.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think we're actually exploring it kind of on the post game, is like getting the people who know nothing about lacrosse to break down lacrosse plays, because it was very similar. Did you ever see Snoop Dogg watching animal documentaries, and it's Snoop Dogg providing commentary?
No.
I'll send it to you, or I won't. I'll probably forget. But it's exactly what it sounds. It's Snoop Dogg breaking down, like, river otters, you know, attacking something. And it's like the funniest thing. So I actually really like your answer. I like your answer better than my answer. And I think there's absolutely a market for just completely unknowledgeable people breaking down something they know nothing about.
So let me just make sure that I'm shouting out Lucy Siegel and Adele Duner, who I believe were the two women that I'm referring to who delivered this commentary. But yeah, that was my funniest moment of the year. And I think that you should reach out to them and see whether or not you can get them involved in some, you know, PLL post-game work. Might be a treasure trove.
I might. I very well might.
What was the biggest surprise of the year for you?
So I have two answers, actually.
I thought you said you only had one, and then you were going to go into panic ordering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I just remembered. The first is how good the SoCon was. And I think that that's, like, one of the only true changing of the guards. Like, the big storyline was, yes, the Ivy League and the corrupt administration, you know, put Ivy League over the ACC. But at the end of the day, I can accept that the Ivy League was better than the ACC. It was like, oh, wow, like, this is kind of the end of the, you could just assume that Virginia and Duke and formerly Maryland in the ACC and Notre Dame and Syracuse just kind of tap dance their way, to victory. Like everything can be a scrap, and Princeton and Yale and Brown and Cornell, it was like, oh man, like there's not an easy game in the Ivy League sans Dartmouth. And I think the more interesting storyline was Jacksonville, Richmond, and High Point. You know, like Richmond beating Virginia, High Point putting everybody, Jacksonville beating Duke. So the SoCon actually being legitimate, and we talked about it, Richmond's poaching recruits from UVA in Virginia. You know, how many kids are going to go to High Point instead of Duke because High Point's pitch now includes, listen, we got Tim Trautner, we got Ashton Olting in the PLL. Like, come and build something special here with us. We got John Galloway, a young coach in Florida. Tell me he's not telling kids from upstate New York, come down here where you don't have to freeze your balls off in January, February. So that was my favorite surprise of the year. My second favorite surprise of the year was the amount of texts and DMs that I got after Colin Reich of St. Joe's Lacrosse scored two goals against Yale and people realizing that he's actually good and not just a complete shithead, being an intern for the post game. So the collective surprise that he can score goals was like actually one of my favorite and funny things that I've experienced in a while. Oh shit. Sorry. I just assumed he was terrible. Turns out he's actually not. And I'm like, oh, that's too funny. So those are my two surprises of the year.
So you kind of undercut my biggest surprise of the year, which was not the Ivy League in general, but Harvard specifically. So I guess the best way to try to put myself in the frame of mind of January, which, would be how I would be surprised, right, if something didn't go according to plan or whatever. So, I had four Ivy League teams in my top 20. Princeton was the lowest ranked at 17. I did not have Brown or Harvard. I would have had, Brown probably between 20 and 26. But I probably wouldn't have had Harvard inside even the top 35. I had seen him practice in the fall, and I thought they looked fine. Not great. The simple fact is that the combination of their, hot start and their continued improvement over the course of the year. And then really their Princeton game is one of the most dominant performances that I've seen over the course. And, when I say dominant, right, like I'm just saying in terms of, you put them on the field with a quality opponent, they come away with a big victory like that. Like it was impressive. So Harvard was my biggest surprise of the year in terms of, positivity. Like I'm not going to dispute that the SoCon played really well. And I think that, for me there, so I had High Point at 16 in the preseason. I probably would have had Richmond at 21 or 22 and Jacksonville at like 27. I guess I'm surprised, but, not as surprised as I am that Harvard ended up being a top 15 team. Even if they hadn't made the NCAA tournament, they probably still would have been my answer for the team that surprised me the most.
Yeah. Whether or not they making the tournament was fair and just, that again,
it's a conversation for another time.
I like that answer. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just not something that has been analyzed or discussed closely enough. So I really just think that whether or not Harvard deserved to make the NCAA tournament, just it probably requires its own podcast, really.
Yeah.
And maybe series, like a serial of podcasts, so to speak.
Where we lay out everything, and like at the end, we blame Donna for inflation and gas prices.
All right. Once again, perfect segue, not inflation and gas prices, but your second surprise into one of my responses for goal of the year. Nick, what was your goal of the year?
Very good question. And I think that I always think that the moments has to play a part in goal of the year. It's why I don't think, objectively, I think the best hockey goal of all time was, Ovechkin kind of sliding on his back and going over the head. But that's not my favorite hockey goal of all time because that was to go up five goals. So I think that the moment in which you are all-time flashy, cocky, there's weight on the line. If you miss it, you look like the biggest jackass of all time. this honestly wasn't really that big of a decision for me because it's Mike Robinson going behind the back to score top cheddar against Georgetown for unequivocally the biggest upset of the tournament, but potentially the biggest upset of the year. And it just is like, honestly, if I'm a coach right now, I lean into the portal and into people from Peterborough because for him to have the stones to do that in a big time moment, the accuracy of the behind the back, him making it look easy, like that is a difficult shot to put any sauce on. That was going, you know, 70, 75 miles an hour in a big moment. And it just like, you know, I just felt like the entire lacrosse world just was completely captivated and going like, oh my God, what is in the water in Delaware? And then if you do research, it's like, oh, it's actually the Peterborough water. That was my favorite goal of the year.
Yeah, no, I think that what's in the water in Delaware is like the chemical runoff from whatever DuPont plant is like right next to Newark.
Yeah, let's not discuss the Delaware water quality. That's a serial episode.
For me, and that's a great answer, my bronze medalist is Timmy Lee's spinning backhand game-winning goal against Lehigh. James Shipley's game winner with 0.5 seconds left in Charlotte against Penn State is my silver medalist. And then, so those obviously very much align with your stakes matter. But my goal of the year is Tucker Brown's fake flip against Wagner that took the deflection, hit the ground, and then defied physics to sneak right under the crossbar because it just is historic. It basically said that gravity is no longer a constant. So for me, I mean, when you're just rewriting textbooks for 11th graders, that's the goal of the year. So congratulations, Tucker Brown.
Yeah. Also worth calling out, Tucker scoring big goals. You know, Dordovic's completely cocky one-on-none between the legs flash show. Granted, Syracuse ended up being a dump, but maybe they're, you know, hey, if you're listening to this podcast and you're thinking about naming a kid, maybe talk to your pregnant wife about Tucker because he's probably going to score a sick goal at some point.
There you go. And that's a great call out too, because that was probably the highlight of the year, I would think, that Tucker Dordovic goal. So yeah, thank you for not letting this podcast end without bringing that one up. Nick, there you go. My game of the year, yeah. I'm going to give a shout out to the NCAA championship. Because even though it sucked for like 47 minutes, something like that, the last 12 were really compelling. Army-Navy is always awesome. It's particularly awesome when it ends in overtime, and it's particularly awesome when the underdog wins in overtime. Speaking of overtime game winners, I'm going to shout out the Utah-Bellarmine-SoCon semifinal matchup in which Bellarmine was leading 12-11 with like 3 seconds left before, or I think Utah scored to tie it with 7 seconds after Bellarmine had the ball on their offensive end with like 40 seconds to go, and then Utah won it overtime. And then my game of the year is the Yale-Harvard regular season matchup that ended with Thomas Bragg's third goal of the game, all coming on extra man, the last coming in overtime. What was your game of the year?
Funny enough, it's a Yale game. I thought that St. Joe-Yale game
was... Oh, I'm so glad you picked that.
Yeah, it was the most fun. I felt like a little kid getting interested in lacrosse again, where... It would be and I know we already broke it down on a previous episode, but the notes were just, this is what makes college lacrosse so fun. Everyone is good, and subsequently everyone is still a kid and bad. So it was like a car accident. I couldn't look away. Is this going to be a very good offensive series with, you know, good ball movement, off ball action, or is someone just going to throw a lefty piss missile and just put the team on their back? Is the goalie has the ball for Yale or St. Joe? Are they going to, you know, do the safe outlet? Are they going to, you know, be face coachable and work
then,
on that?
And then yeah. Tiptoe down the sideline with a one-handed cradle?
Yeah. Or are they going to do that? Or are they just going to, you know, hit a nine iron into the corner for no reason? Like, you probably had a guy went open. So that game had it all, from high level execution, low level execution, both teams looking like they could win it at any moment. Great individual performances all around. You know, it had the upset story. It had everything. So that was, it might not be one of the best games of all time, but it's been a long time since I've just sat and felt like a kid at a candy store watching a lacrosse game and enjoying it that much.
No, it's a great call.
But also that Harvard-Yale game, I got to say, that's a great answer too. That was like, that was appreciating a slugfest. And I feel like, you know, Yale-St. Joe was watching a shit show.
Yeah. No, it was on my list, and I didn't want more than four answers on my list. But the other game, in the same way that the Tucker Dordovic goal needs to be a part of the conversation about goal of the year, even if it's not your choice or my choice, the Penn-Princeton regular season game that I believe Princeton won 22-21, that needs to be a part of any conversation for game of the year.
It's the antithesis of Notre Dame, which is kind of funny. I remember we beat Penn State my sophomore year 4-3. So it's good to see that there's still the 22-21 victories. So
who was your player of the year? If you say Logan Wasnowskis, I'm ending the podcast. He's already gotten enough awards.
I was just going to say, like, him only for, like, you know, the decision-making. I feel like, again, what the only thing that isn't being talked about is, like, him not pulling trigger on good shots. So, like, good for him. But, I mean, it's tough because, you know, I don't know. I struggle to find player of the year. But my player of the year would be can you go first? Actually, I'm panic ordering after yours. I need to hear someone think about it.
My player of the year is Ajax Zapatello, and the reason he's my player of the year is because coming into the season we didn't think he was going to start. At midseason he got a couple of All-America votes. He was an honorable mention, I believe, midseason All-American, and I thought that those people were just like overreacting. He was, in my opinion, like pretty clearly the number three defenseman on a good defense, right? Like probably like the second or third best defense in the country. I think that if the Schmeisser Award voting were to happen right now, he would win it. I mean, his performance in the tournament was absolutely outrageous. And it's so hard to evaluate defenders. There's just so many components to how are matchups being designed. How is he, you know, doing all the other things other than covering the ball that are important. And, you know, you watch the game, and obviously you don't know the nuances of their game plan. You can't hear their in-unit communication. But when you consider all of the injuries to Maryland's defense down the stretch, and the fact that they won because of their defense, and this is not a slight to Matt Rahill, by the way. He did a tremendous job guarding John Piatelli in the final, and, you know, is just an excellent kind of communicator off-ball defender. But he's a multi-year starter, right? Like, I wasn't so surprised to see what Matt Rahill was able to do. And, you know, Breck Makar was obviously, you know, limited in the championship game, but then he was also, you know, hampered by injury at points throughout the season as well. And Ajax Zapatello, and the other thing that I'll say is that, you know, the storyline that was brought up on so many broadcasts about, you know, contributors from geographically diverse areas, and specifically the number of guys from Portland, Oregon, who have really contributed. Like, Zapatello was a player who just did all the things that I said that he did, and was like the last guy, if he was brought up at all in these conversations, behind guys like Ross Scott, Sam Hanley, and the like. And you know, not to say that those guys don't deserve all the attention that they receive, but it just has felt to me, and it's a weird thing to say because I'm responsible for shining a lot of spotlight on these types of games, or these types of guys, excuse me, but it was, for me, Ajax Zapatello was just absolutely awesome. Nick, I'm going to interrupt our regularly scheduled podcast to let you know that a Water Dog defenseman, and I obviously have the sound turned down, so I'm not sure who it was, just executed a between the legs back to the goal, like the Cody Jameson style goal, to cut the Cannons lead to 15-9 with 8 minutes to go in this game. That was incredible. I think it was number 15. I don't know if you know who that is.
I have the game up right now, and I don't know if I'm on a delay. Right now it's 15-8, so
you're going to want to keep your eyes peeled.
Deductive reasoning. All right, I will keep – so I will live react to it. So just get ready for that. My funny answer for player of the year is Hugh Keller. I love a good – whatever, close enough.
It was close enough.
Number 27 on court.
Yeah. Hugh, related to Helen Keller.
Yeah. And I love someone who just is like, here's what I do. And he just puts his head down. He borderline was like, should have been ejected for targeting as a Dodger. And he would shoot it a million miles an hour, not even get close. So he has a special place in my heart. I also love the guys. I think it's kind of a funny answer, but also I sneaky legitimately believe it is Tucker Brown, the midfielder for St. Joe. I was blown away with how good he was, being dominant, getting to his left hand. And I think he has one of the better shots on the run, because when you're running parallel to the goal line, it's really difficult to put a little extra cheese, a little extra sauce on that shot. The way that he would snap his wrist, and it didn't even look like he was aiming left or right. It just looked like, I'm going to shoot it as hard as I can, 1 inch underneath the crossbar. I was consistently impressed. I only watched a handful of St. Joe's games, but every time I was like, God damn, if I'm a PLL coach, like I'm seriously considering putting him on a roster. So that's my a little bit more serious answer, but I just don't think I pay attention enough to individual performances enough to give a better answer than you.
Once again, to interrupt this podcast, I'm pretty sure that this is going to be bad news for you. That goal was scored by your boy, Eli Gobrecht. You might have to say something nice about
it. Okay, hold on. So there's 10 minutes left in the fourth quarter right now with where I'm at. So I think I'm pretty far away. And the Water Dogs just got a man up. So I might be pretty far behind here.
You are still about a minute or a minute and a half behind this goal being scored. So,
okay, cool.
Let's make sure to interrupt the ultimate moment of the podcast to talk about our team of the year. And in the same way that you weren't allowed to pick Logan Wisnauskas and you ended up doing so anyway, you're not allowed to pick Maryland. Uh-huh. So who is your team of the year?
Team of the year is Jacksonville. And
that's a good answer.
It's a good answer. It's a little stereotypical, but again, I think it represents a lot more. I think there are a couple things that I love and that I'm willing to kind of start dying on hills for. One is, I think, younger coaches. What could I choose, Cornell and Buzik? Yes, but that's kind of like a historically, it's easier to recruit at Cornell than it is at Jacksonville. So I love that you have a young, recently played at a high level player. I think that does a lot. Oh my God, that was a ridiculous save. The backside man up action, just going from left to right, that's really good. So I think Jacksonville has the essence of, oh man, younger coaches doing well. I love that storyline. And also what we were talking about earlier in the pod is the SoCon is real, and I love things that introduce a little bit more parity. So if Jacksonville's good with a young coach, with a guy who rubs his tum-tum after a goal and has a huge, massive barrel, I think they kind of put together and cherry-picked a lot of things that I like about college lacrosse and a lot of things that I like about individual teams and a lot of things that I like about individual performances and made it this really cool and interesting season for them. And I hope that, the rest of the SoCon can play well enough to where SoCon wins a Richmond over a High Point, a High Point over a Jacksonville, as those three teams beat up on each other. Oh, my God. That was Eli. Are you kidding me? Holy shit.
Did you know he had that in?
If you're listening to this, start playing box lacrosse. I can't – so – one of my sneaky takes that I threw out there on Twitter was that Eli will be in contention for Defensive Player of the Year. Oh my God. And then he shrugs and walks off. He was like, okay, I just scored. Absolutely unbelievable. Good for him. If you're playing lacrosse, start playing box lacrosse. Eli, I'm glad that you had the season that you did on this. Like, he's on trajectories right now, becoming a staple on an NLL roster. And if he can add, you know, the stick skills to do that, I mean, he's headed for a really interesting 2-3 year in addition to this season. My God, dude.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive.
Jacksonville's cool because they have a lot of stuff that I like. Yeah. What about you?
My team of the year is Princeton. It's not Maryland. You know, I think that I kind of already laid out the argument in terms of, you know, I had him ranked 17 in the preseason. And to me, you know, they didn't play Maryland as close as Cornell did, but they played a ton of great games over the course of the season. I expected Cornell basically the point I'm making is that how much better Princeton was relative to my preseason expectations was greater than the same delta for Cornell, because I thought Cornell was going to be a lot better than Princeton. So to that end, I wasn't as surprised by what the Big Red did in the national championship game relative to what, how surprised I was and impressed I was by what Princeton did over the course of the season. And particularly because, you know, they got some contributions from guys that I didn't even know were going to be asked to fill the roles that they filled. So, you know, Chris Brown, for instance, when we last saw him, he was essentially the goal scorer to complement Michael Sowers. And he turned into a consummate quarterback who was able to dodge, feed, and assist. And Alex Lusher, who I thought was going to be their quarterback, turned into one of the most dangerous goal scorers of the year. And, you know, they had so much versatility in terms of their defenders' ability to take number one matchups and either win or comport themselves well. And, you know, I thought there was going to be a goalie battle in the preseason. I thought that Mike Gianforcaro was going to, you know, potentially win that job. And Eric Peters, through the first half of the year, looked like the best goalie. You know, Tyler Sandoval was not expected to be one of the best faceoff guys. And then he ended up doing exactly what the Tigers needed him to do in the NCAA tournament in order to compete. You know, this was a staff that I felt like every step of the way kind of had a beat of their team. They missed the Ivy League tournament after having been, you know, kind of the team of the year for the majority of the early part of the season. And that ultimately ended up being a benefit because of how they were able to rest and recover and because of how they were able to reanalyze what they wanted to do. And, you know, they didn't play their best game in the first round of the NCAA tournament, and they advanced past Boston U. And then whether or not they played their best game against Yale in the quarterfinals, they certainly played well enough to win. And, you know, like I said, I felt like their performance at the offensive end was left lacking against Maryland, but I really think that was by and large due to the athleticism of Maryland's defense. And I was really impressed by what the Tigers did at the defensive end of the field in the semifinal against the Terps and how physically they played. So Princeton's my team of the year. It's good to give it to the low guy.
That's just great. Yeah. What a beautiful mind you have, Terry. He went to Princeton.
Good joke.
I do have another moment of the year that I'd like to bring up.
Sure.
I thought it was really cool that Charlotte North sells out arenas. And I think that kind of like the trajectory of women's lacrosse, particularly as it relates to this Boston College UNC game, I don't pretend to be a big women's lacrosse fan because I just, you know, there's only so many sports that I follow in the same way that I don't watch baseball, but I enjoy it. I feel like that's kind of always how I've approached women's lacrosse. I think that she's, you know, literally changing the game. And when I tuned into that Boston College UNC final, I was like, holy shit, this is about as entertaining as it gets. Just, you know, really good plays all over the field, the storylines playing out, all that good stuff. And I was telling someone this because they were like, damn, women's lacrosse just beat the shit out of men's from an entertainment and, you know, the look of the crowd and all that stuff. I think it's pretty cool that in the same way that men's lacrosse, I feel, and maybe this is just because it's directly related to my interest in it and kind of, but I feel like it started to blow up a little bit kind of in like 2005 to 2008, where I started seeing it more on TV. It was easier to tune into championship games. It was fun to watch the storylines. I only knew a couple players on the team, but that was enough for me to follow. And when they would score, I would freak out. And I feel like for the first time, there's kind of this revolution going on the women's side where if you're a young player, it's becoming easier to just tune into your family's cable package and watch a player that you've heard about, whether it's Charlotte North or Ortega or, you know, whoever. So I just thought that that was a really cool moment of the year. And I'm happy for all the fans that get to kind of be a part of this first batch of superstardom, you know, in Charlotte North for women's lacrosse. So that was another moment of the year that I thought was pretty cool. Cause you know, we're sitting around in a room full of dudes that are just, you know, farting and drinking beer. And we're kind of like, this is sick. Like, this is a really entertaining, awesome, fun game. So that I'll just throw that out there as, you know, a little, oh, that was cool.
No, it's a great call out. I mean, and for me, this is this has been a 2.5 year build that culminated, right? And it's funny because I don't think very many people realize that the national championship game sold out in 2019 as well. And I make that point to illustrate that there were fans in 2019, but the broader awareness wasn't as wide. I think that the creation of the ACC network and then the relationship with ESPNU that they naturally have and then the quasi-rivalry that has clearly emerged between the ACC network and the Big Ten network has been so substantially beneficial for women's sports generally and women's lacrosse specifically, because those networks are called to represent gender equity more so than ESPNU had been for the 15 preceding years. And just the volume of content has, you know, created a little bit of an arms race for the non-Big Ten and ACC programs to increase their sideline highlights and everything that goes along with that, and their narrative storytelling and everything that goes along with that too. And I think it was, for me, the story of the year last year, right? But I'm like, I'm in it. You know what I mean? I was noticing it because I'm on Lax Twitter all day, every day. This is the year that I think it broke beyond the borders of just the people who are in it, in terms of like how much easier it is to access, how much better it is to watch. And that's one thing that we can't, you know, neglect to say. Like the worst moment of the year actually was every time the goal mouth mattered, because the goal mouth is the worst thing. It represents the worst thing to happen to men's lacrosse in 10 years since we've started on this like trajectory toward adding the shot clock. Because it's just so dumb. And it was so dumb from the outset. And everybody who thought about it for 5 seconds knew how dumb it was going to be. And the reason I bring it up when I'm otherwise talking about women's lacrosse is because, generally speaking, they have nailed every single one of their rule changes. And the difference between women's lacrosse and men's lacrosse is that women's lacrosse really desperately needed it. It was hard to understand and it was hard to watch because there were so many stoppages. There are fewer stoppages now. They're more intuitively understood. And as a result, the game is flowing so much more and allowing players to play so much more in conjunction with the creation or the, you know, allowance of using mesh pockets, which, you know, has allowed these players to hold the ball better and shoot harder. So once all these games were on TV, the game was so much more ready for the volume of what was on TV than it would have been 6, 7, 8 years prior. And so, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that it had a moment. It wasn't just the championship, but it certainly was punctuated by the championship this year. And that's an awesome thing to see in terms of, you know, what it means for the sport going forward. And now, hopefully, men's lacrosse advocates see it as a gauntlet, right? The women's lacrosse stakeholders have invested in their game so substantially over the course of the last however many years. And it's not to say that men's lacrosse hasn't been invested in, but it hasn't seen the same level of growth. And now, like I said, hopefully the interpretation is that the gauntlet has been thrown down.
I completely agree. And credit to me for bringing it up in the first place. I'm not sure you would have.
What a note to end on. Nick, you're a beauty. Appreciate you joining us on the Tailgate Podcast. Love you.
Love you too. Until next time.
Don't know when next time's going to be. We're going to have to hop on the horn and figure it out.
I look forward to that conversation.
Hey, brother.
Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the Tailgate.
Hey,
sister. No, the water's sweet, but blood is thicker.